Okay, I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. This is TechNet number 1690. It will be Science and Physics Report number 20 and Space Report number 290. We're running an experiment tonight. We're going to find out, is there any ham radio operator that's more interested in TechNet than the Academy Awards? Is anybody not watching the Academy Awards? We're going to find that out. Let me drop. Roy, with his science and physics report tonight, has a number of very interesting subjects, which I've gone down that list and I said, wow. Also, NASA is doing some interesting things. Some people have just come back from space, so we're going to hear a lot about that. Also, the March issue of 2018, the March issue of Scientific American, has a beautiful article you're going to want to see. If you have any interest in exoplanets and the search for life beyond the Earth. And they listed about 4 or 5 programs right now. A couple of them in operation, a couple of them about to be in operation. There's going to be more and more searches for exoplanets, Earth-like planets. They're already up to something like 3,000, and that number is about to go up real fast. They know where to look to find those ETs. So that's a good issue to get a hold of. And right now, Scientific American is probably on your favorite newsstand, the March 2018 issue. Let me drop. You guys have heard me say a zillion times, main purpose of the TechNet is entertainment, is education. A little bit of entertainment sneaks in. People who are curious about wireless equipment, radio equipment, ham radio equipment in particular, and other subjects of interest to ham radio operators, which involve astronomy, science, and physics. This is the place where they gather for the last 34 and a half years. This is TechNet number 1690, as I mentioned to you guys. I never expected it to last this long, way back in 1982 when this all got started. A person signs into the TechNet because he does have a question or a comment by giving this group your call letters, your name. I don't remember to give me your name because I'm so non-forgetful. I like referring to people by their name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in because you're listening. After 34 and a half years of people signing in from multiple states, believe somebody is listening. Let me drop. Eric has informed us that IRLP is working. Echolink right now is not working, unfortunately. But he must be able to establish that later on during the net. The connection to the 975-375 repeater in both directions, I'm double-checking that right now, and sure enough, that is working. So we've got connection to 975-375, we've got IRLP, by way of Roy monitoring the chat room. We probably have chat room, and people can leave messages that way and get things to us while we're talking. So, We're 90% in operation. I'm going to take check-ins right now. Is there anybody out there that's not watching the Academy Awards that wants to discuss ham radio? Please give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW, are you listening? Please wait for the beeps in between each QSO.
And Rio.
W-H-Y-Y-Y, yes.
Okay, so far we got Rich and Joe. I know Joe's going to be talking about that interesting data that he took on his antenna, 6-meter antenna. So we got Rich and Joe. Anyone else to check in? Is there anybody else out there? Not watching the Academy Awards at this time. Give me a call with his name right now after the beep.
Hey, listening.
Okay, I got John, KC2SHO, from Los Alamos. A famous place. There's some interesting work that takes place, did take place, and is taking place. Alrighty, anyone else who does have a question or a comment, give me a call with his name right now. K2LAW listening.
WS2N, Paul, with a space report. Good evening, Dick. And put me down for a question.
Very time, Paul. Oh, you got Paul, WS2N with a question. One last call. Anyone to check in because they do have a question or a comment for the TechNet, please give me a call, let us name right now after the beeps. If we don't have, even if we did have a brief bit of questions and answers and comments tonight, because we've got so darn many interesting subjects with reference to science, technology, and space, we have more than enough time to fill up the space. Okay, Rich and 2EO, how are things going in Massapequa Park? And Newsday recently reported that Massapequa Park is the place in the United States that has the greatest amount of opiate, you know what I mean, drug problems. I know that you don't run into that, but apparently your town does. N2EO, K2LAW.
Jake, N2EO. I did not know that. That's not good. I have a question, a medical question, for Roy, if that's permitted. And first I want to say, I really appreciate what Eric does for everybody in the club, including myself. I think we should all be, what do you call it? You know what I'm trying to say.
Yes, Eric is maintaining a lot of equipment at the Glen Oak site, at the Selden site, at the remote receiver sites, and working that hard, I think we should double his salary. Okay, if you've got a brief medical question for Roy, go right ahead and ask it. And 2EO, K2RIW.
Okay, Dick. I think everybody knows that Tourette's syndrome is a neurological disorder that I've been taking medicine for since I'm 17 years old. That's when I was first diagnosed properly. I'm now 67. And I know that people who take these meds many, many years like me run the risk of developing something called tardive dyskinesia. And I wonder what Roy knows, because I have tremors in my hands, my mouth is dry, I gotta keep drinking stuff. I don't know. Well, what my internist referred me to a neurologist, which helped me to vaccinate and to be a...
Hey, if Roy is available, let's see if he's got some words of wisdom on that particular subject. AC2GS, K2LAW, go right ahead, Dr. Roy.
Yes, this is AC2GS, and my words of wisdom would primarily be to let the neurologist examine you, and then based on a thorough examination, give you an explanation of what's going on. It's easier to explain quantum mechanics over a radio than it is to make a diagnosis over the radio. Part of dyskinesia is due to the medications that you've taken. People who are taking any kind of antipsychotic medication have a tendency to develop it. I wouldn't exactly describe your symptoms as the standard for tardive dyskinesia, but it can present in slightly different ways, and you might require a modification of your medication schedule. But it should be done with a neurologist who's examined you.
Okay, Roy. I've always been very upset that they use antipsychotic medications, because Tourette's syndrome is neurological based, and they have to use these meds because they don't have anything better. So I've always been very upset about that. And no, I'll see the neurologist, but real quick, without taking too much of your time, how do you tell the difference between tardive dyskinesia and other names or something similar?
I'm quite sure. Parkinson's, essential tremors, there are 100 different reasons why people kind of shake a little bit. A tardive dyskinesia is sort of a rolling motion. It's a little bit unusual as opposed to all the other ones that are just kind of static back and forth. There's a couple neurological disorders that have trademark type of motions. Parkinson's has a shuffling gait and has a kind of whipping back and forth type of neurological disturbance. And tardive dyskinesia is more rolling round and round type of thing. So, as I said before, you're best off discussing it with a neurologist. And the reason why they give you antipsychotics is because they tested all the medicines that were available and they found that antipsychotics help. And so you use what you have that helps.
I'll pick up with John in a second. I started off with the two bowling bowls together to let you know that I started off at Lagrange point number one. So the two bowling bowls are together. I'm letting you know that if I didn't do anything, in theory they would sit there forever at Lagrange point number one, the two bowling bowls right alongside of each other. Then I placed them at these two new locations. I did an equal displacement, 11,000 miles toward the moon and bowling ball number two, 11,000 miles toward the earth and bowling ball number one, placed them there, let go, and then said what's going to happen. And that's the quasi-calculation I just gave you. I went through the real numbers with the email that I sent to Roy, and if anybody's really interested, I could make a copy of that for you if you want to look at the actual mathematics. But it's nothing but calculating by inverse square law, Newton's law, how much extra gravity you get when you half the distance to the moon, how much extra gravity you get when you half the distance to the earth, and because the one distance is a big percentage, 50%, and the other one is only a 5% change, so to speak, the gravity moves a lot faster toward the moon for that amount of displacement. Let's see what John's going to say on this one. WA2VDH, K2LIW, wait for the beep, and you got it, John.
I think the word we're looking for is gradient, gravitational gradient. To use your analogy where this is like a tip of a mountain, the mountain is far steeper going to the moon, and it's more shallow sloping downhill going to the earth. And that's sort of the representation of the gravitational gradient. Go ahead.
Yeah, give that man a cigar. I should have used the word gravity gradient. You're absolutely right. So when you're looking at the proper Lagrange website, when you ask for the Lagrange points, you'll see that the gradient lines are closer together on the Lagrange point number one toward the moon, and they're further apart on the Lagrange point number one toward the earth. The gradient lines are further spaced. Very similar to the pressure lines you get on a weather map as to, you get a low pressure center and you get a whole lot of lines real close. Equipressure lines. I can't think of the right word for it right now. Isobars. Beautiful. So the isobars, when you've got very close together isobars, you're going to, in general, get a lot of wind out of a low pressure center, for instance. And when there's further questions or comments on this Lagrange point crazy puzzle, given to me by this person from Ward Melville High School. Give me a call, letters right now. K2IW in the Tech Zone. I heard a station attempt to sign in with an extremely noisy signal. Want to give it another try? Okay, very noisy signal, but I heard something Charlie Lima. I heard something Charlie Lima. Want to go a little bit slower and give me your call letters again?
Sorry, Dick. Up in the power. Alpha, Charlie, Q, Papa, Lima.
Okay. I heard Charlie 2, Papa, Lima. I'm going to guess that it got clipped off that you too quick on the microphone button. Is that Kilo Charlie 2 Papa Lima? If so, comment or question. Go right ahead, Papa Lima.
Okay, sorry, Alpha Charlie to Papa Lima, Captain Cullen. And I think the thing that tipped the answer for me was your mention of the saddle point. And it's an asymmetric saddle point because the proximity to the well in space-time near the moon is going to be much, much steeper. If you think of tipping it off the saddle point that you mentioned, it's going to just head down that well a lot quicker, more quickly because of the steepness of the due proximity of the gravitational pull of the moon, right?
Yeah, when I used to, I'm dropping. When I used a horse saddle as an example, a horse saddle is not quite what we... it gives you a feeling for partially stable equilibrium. A BB right in the middle of the saddle, in theory, will sit there, and if you push it a little bit to the left or the right, it's going to fall off the saddle. Well, the Lagrange point number one, let me think about that. Is it a saddle? Yeah, I think it is. Maybe it is a saddle. You push the BB forward or aft on the horse, and it rolls back to the neutral point. So there is a direction on a Lagrange point number one where you could move it, and it'll be restored. But there's a direction where it will not be restored. So I guess it is a saddle. But looking at the gravity gradient lines toward the moon, they're much closer together. Whenever you draw gravity gradient lines around any object, Earth, Moon, or whatever, because you're putting a satellite around that object, the lines get closer together as you get closer to the center of the object, and they get further and further apart as you get farther away. If I'm putting a satellite in a low Earth orbit, and I change the altitude of the satellite a small amount, I'm going to see a significant difference in the amount of gravity that I sense. Let me drop. But if I put my satellite at a geosynchronous orbit, 22,300 miles away from the center of the Earth, or from the Earth's surface, I think it is, and I change it by the same amount, change the altitude of the satellite, I get a very minor change in the amount of gravity that I sense. So, inverse square law, gravity behaves that way. And so you're really coming up against that very strongly with this bowling ball example. And a similar gravity gradient problem is that maybe we're not going to give you the answer to this one, but I'm going to throw it out. Make believe that Roy, the Loffer Scientific Company, Roy's last name is Loffer, the Loffer Scientific Company has invented a gravity sensing machine. It works very well. It has a very good front-to-back ratio. At high noon, Roy aimed that machine toward the sun and measured the amount of sun gravity getting to the Earth. He caught that measurement. Let me drop. Then at midnight, the very next night, when there was a full moon, he aimed his machine toward the moon and measured the amount of moon gravity reaching the Earth. And again, the gravity detecting machine has got a good front-to-back ratio. When he's aiming it toward the moon, it measures the amount of moon gravity independent of Earth and sun. At high noon, when he aimed it toward the sun, it's measuring the amount of sun gravity independent of Earth and moon. So he's made these two measurements. The question is, which measurement was bigger and why? The confusing things about this is that the moon is much smaller, but it's much closer. The sun is much larger, but it's much further away. So those are some clues of two fighting forces. And by the way, the difference between the two, which measurement is bigger? We're not talking about minor difference here. It's major. There's a couple of other factors that you know very well that relate to this that you might catch on. So we're not going to give you the answer to that one tonight. But yet again, I'm curious as to whether or not you guys, now you've got a good, strong feeling for gravity, which is the stronger measurement? Solar gravity or lunar gravity? Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, do you have something in Echolink trying to get in here, Tech? That's maybe that where that hum is coming from.
Not sure where the hum is coming from. You got a guess on this one, Joe?
No, I just was listening to this thing. Maybe it's let the repeaters don't transfer for like 5 or 6 seconds. It'll let somebody on Echolink try to get in. I don't know where the hum is coming from. Sounds like somebody from Echolink possibly wants to talk.
Coming from somebody peeing up on Echolink.
It might be VE3SAW. I think that's Sam. SAW, go right ahead. Wait for the beeps.
This is Bill, W2SAW. The moon causes pronounced tidal effects and the sun doesn't, so I'm guessing the moon is stronger.
Bill, you've given a very good common sense answer. And the chances are the more complete answer will surprise you. And the explanation will also surprise you. So, Bill has given us an answer. The moon's gravity must be stronger because it creates tidal effects, and the sun does not create tidal effects. But then you've got to consider near-field effects versus far-field effects. And you'll be kind of amazed. Anybody else want to give us a guess? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and TechNet. We got to wait for all those beeps.
US 2N.
Okay, we waited for all the beeps. Paul, go right ahead with your whatever.
A lot of beeps. Okay, Paul, based on the diameter, I'm not going to go by the mass, but the diameter of the sun compared to the moon, and then the distance compared to the distance from here to the moon. It's 400 to 1 ratio. So, you know, whatever the distance is between here and the moon, which is roughly 250,000 miles, it's supposed to be about 400 times more than that to the sun. And the sun is 400 times the diameter of the moon. So that, you know, I mean, that gives us the nice eclipses that we see, but maybe based on that, the gravitational effects would be about the same. I'll go with about the same. Was that a choice? Back to you, Dick.
Yes, the word same. Let me drop for the older beeps. Because it makes the tides. The sun could be greater because it's much bigger in the mass, because they both give you the same angular subtended angle when you look at them, obviously by a total eclipse. They could be the same. So moon could be greater, sun could be greater, they could both be the same. The answer, even on those choices, the answer will still surprise you. Anybody else have any further guesses? Give me your call letters and name right now. K2RIW, the Tech Man. Maybe Dr. Roy has a guess on this one. I know you guys know how to calculate it. You know how to calculate inverse square law. You know how to look up the mass of the sun, the mass of the moon. Therefore, I know you know how to calculate this. I'm asking for a gut feel. You've lived under that moon, you've lived under that sun for all of your years of your life. Therefore, you might have a gut feel as to which is giving a greater amount of gravity. AC2GS, K2RIW. You got it right.
AC2GS. Well, with tidal forces, you really have to think in terms of differentials of gravitational force. So you can't just say there's tidal forces on one, so the force is a great deal more than in the second case, because if an object is far enough away, even though it might have incredible force, it has no differential changes in the force. in relationship to the ocean. So tide sounds like a good reason, but it really isn't. You just have to kind of sit there and figure out how masses compare and how distances compare. And unfortunately, I tend to do equations, so I did equations. So I think I sort of know, so I don't want to ruin it for anyone.
If you'd ever looked at the right diagram on the subject of the tides, there's not one tide per day, but there's two tides per day. Because of the moon's gravity, you get a bulge of water essentially toward the moon. You get another bulge of water on the back side of the Earth, away from the moon. And those two bulges move around the Earth, so to speak, in synchronization with that moon. Or another way of looking at it is the water is sitting still with reference to the moon, and the Earth is turning on its once per 24 hours underneath. So there's a crazy differential. I mean, how in the world can the moon's gravity create a suction of the water toward the moon and a non-suction of the water on the back side of the Earth? Let me drop. You may think that the moon is going around the Earth. In reality, the moon-Earth system is a binary pair of objects. To some degree, they're in orbit around each other. The Earth happens to be 81 times heavier than the moon. Therefore, as the moon goes around the Earth, it creates a wobble of the Earth. It looks to you and me like the moon is going around the Earth. In reality, most moon and Earth are rotating around a point that's roughly 1,000 miles below the equator. 1,000 miles below the equator, 3,000 miles from the center of the Earth, at that equal mass point. It's got a better name, I can't think of it right now. Epicenter. I think you called it epicenter. What was that again?
It's called the barycenter.
Okay. That barycenter. The Earth is operating, is rotating around that barycenter. The moon is operating. The binary system of Earth and moon is operating around that barycenter, roughly 1,000 miles below the equator at any one instant of time. The way the Earth is wobbling because of the moon, that creates a slosh of water on the back side of the Earth, as well as a gravitational attraction on the front side. So the tides are a heck of a lot more complicated than first meets the eye. I'm going to turn it over to Roy. I think we're going to let this one sit for a week, if that's Roy's choice. And maybe he's going to go on to one of his other zillion subjects. AC2GS, our science physics maven, K2RA. Go ahead, Roy.
I just want to point out that if anyone has a design for an excellent front-to-back ratio gravitational detector, please let me know. We can probably patent it and make zillions of dollars, because unfortunately, although electromagnetism can be reflected, gravitational fields can't. And you can factor in the other gravitational forces, just, you know, design a circuit that you can add them to it once you figure out what it might be. But I know of no detector that can figure out where the gravitational force, say, is coming and null out the backside. So that would be a great design. If any of you guys have it, please send it to me, email, and we'll share the Nobel Prize and the profit. Let me drop. I just want to pick up a couple of things with the Lagrange point. The problem with Lagrange points originally, of course, were that two-body equations are relatively easy to do. Three-body are almost impossible to do. So the trick with Lagrange and three bodies is they use a technique called restricted three-body, which means one of the three bodies have to be incredibly tinier than the other two. And even if you use that constraint, you end up with a very, very complicated equation that includes numbers to the fifth order. It's not a quadratic, it's a quintic equation. And God love you, that's a pain in the backside. So by assuming that one of the two bodies is less than 25 times, is more than 25 times the other body of the two major bodies, you can reduce it to a quadratic equation and you can solve it. and you solve it for five different points. L1 is the first Lagrange point. Let me drop. As many mentioned and Dick mentioned, it's a saddle point in that it doesn't really like to go sideways. It's pretty stable sideways, but it's quasi-stable front to back between the Earth and the Moon. So if you just leave it there, it'll eventually wobble towards the Moon or towards the Earth. That's why for L1, L2, and L3, you need station-keeping rockets to maintain it. It requires very little power to maintain it, but you have to actually actively keep it there. So L1 is between the Earth and the Moon, around the gravitational center. It's probably a little closer to the Earth because of the rotational aspects. L2 is on the other side of the Moon, about the same distance. And then L3 is on the other side of the orbit, opposite to where the Moon is, a little bit farther out of orbit than the Moon is. And that's L1, L2, and L3. L4 and L5 is kind of difficult to explain. The best way I could say is they're equilateral triangles with one of the legs being L1 and L2. So if you're 60 degrees off in one direction, that's L4, 60 degrees off in the other, L5, and they make little equilateral triangles. They're very, very stable. You can put something there, and as long as something doesn't mess it up from something other orbiting, it will stay there for a very, very long time. Let me drop. The problem, though, is with all these pseudo-stable is you either have to have station-keeping, or a lot of times they don't really want their equipment to be pointed directly at things. So they actually set it up with halo orbits and all kinds of meta-stable orbits around their Lagrange point. So there's a lot of that going on. And matter of fact, this doesn't only take place with the Earth and the Moon. It takes place with the Sun and the Earth. We have a Lagrange point for the L1, L2, L3, L4, and L5 for the Earth-Sun system. And what I kind of find interesting is when you get to the L3, and if you remember, the L3 is on the other side, L3 is farther away than Earth's orbit, but it's closer to the Sun. And anyone hazard a guess how you can do both at the same time? The gravitational center where the Earth and the Sun are rotating around, which is not the center of the Sun, but deep inside the Sun to one side. So since there is that little wobble that's going on between the Sun and the Earth, on the other side you could have a distance that's longer than Earth orbit is, but closer to the Sun because of the way that the Sun will wobble during the rotation of Earth around it. Jupiter has moons that are located in L4 and L5. Saturn has moons who have their own Lagrange points and have their own moons at their own L4 and L5 points. And one of the funny things about Earth-Sun L3 is that if you were going to place Planet X, you know, some people believe that there's a phantom planet waiting to attack us and it's hiding on the other side of the solar system, you would probably want to hide it on L3 because that would be the best place to hide it, except that we've had probes that look at L3 and it's empty, probably because Mercury screws up the gravitational forces on that side. That's about what I got on Lagrange points. Find them interesting subjects, and no doubt they'll be used perpetually. There's some research into using them to plot lanes, if you will. If you use Lagrange points and then you find low gravitational fields to get from one to another, you decrease the amount of energy you need to get from one point to another. What you end up doing, though, is it takes...
Repeater, time out.
That's my spiel on Lagrange. Anyone have any comments or questions or statements about Lagrange's? 2N.
Yeah, when it comes to L3, you know, as far as the sun and the earth is concerned, they've never put a satellite in that location. And even if they did, they'd have problems transmitting signals because you can't get anything past the sun. They'd have to have something, you know, either leading or behind the orbit of that location to use that as a repeater. But there's nothing you know, we've never set up a satellite there yet. We've done satellites at L1 and L2. Nothing yet at 4 or 5. But there is an L5 society, an L5 group. They want to set up a space colony at that location. They've been around for decades. And because of that, like what you said, the very stable location at L5, in this case, you know, following the path of the Earth and the Moon as we rotate around, that's the following one. The 4 is in front, 5 is behind. Back to you, this is S2N. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, some planets have a lot of garbage in their L4s and L5. As I mentioned, you have Jupiter with moons, you have Saturn that have moons in L4, L5. We thought we were going to find something interesting in our L4, L5, but maybe there's a little dust there, but there doesn't seem to be anything there. It may just be that nothing kind of took or kept, or there are some other nearby objects that are destabilizing what should be a very stable structure. So, you know, who knows? They have an interesting naming method for asteroids that they find in L4 and L5. In one, they call them Trojan asteroids, and in the other, they call them Greek asteroids, and they name them after Trojan heroes and Greek heroes and such. So they've been going through their old books on the Iliad and the Odyssey there.
We're going to be sending a satellite out to the Trojan one for Jupiter. That's in the works quite a few years from now, but they plan on going to one. Actually, there's two different ones that they want to visit. One called Psyche, and then there's another one. I forget the name of that one. But we're going to be visiting that boy in quite a few, you know, maybe 4 or 5 years down the road.
Very good. The more the merrier. Always nice to learn more about our neighborhood. Unfortunately, we're going to be stuck here for a long time until someone figures some way of defeating the limitations of the speed of light. But until then, we might as well check what's going on in our back yard there.
And I think when you're talking about the moons and Jupiter's and Saturn's L4 and 5 location, I'm pretty sure you were talking about the asteroids. As far as I know, the moons, all the moons of Jupiter and Saturn revolve around the planets. The moons are not located or locked in on 4 or 5.
Okay, I don't know. I mean, I distinctly read someplace that two of Saturn's moons have moons of their own, and they were at L4, L5. I think I wrote it down someplace, but, you know, right now I'm looking for it, and I can't find it.
Okay, so you're saying that there's moons going around, moons of Saturn. Not sure about that. With all the information from Cassini from 2004 until now, I know we'll be able to find that. I gotta check the Cassini website for that one. They'd have to have it.
Okay, the way I have it scribbled down is Saturn has a moon, Dione, which is accompanied by Helene and Polydeuces at L4 and L5. And Saturn also has a moon, Tethys, that's accompanied by their own moon, Callisto and Calypso at L4, L5.
I don't know. That doesn't sound right. Calypso definitely goes around and around. That's one of the Galileo moons. Something's not right there. I don't know. We'll have to look further into it. Back to you.
Okay, we'll both do some further research. It's still able to rotate around Saturn. It just rotates around the moon of Saturn in addition. So it's doing a helical type of revolution within a revolution. Or at least that's what I gleaned from that.
Okay, then, all right. You're not using the Sun, Jupiter, Lagrange points. You're using Lagrange points that are between the Jupiter and maybe one of its moons, maybe one of their Lagrange points, and then you have other moons that are locked into place with the Lagrange points of, let's say, Calypso and Calypso, Jupiter, and then there'll be another one that would be at their Lagrange points, 4 or maybe 5. That would make sense. If they're talking about that makes sense.
Okay, I mean, I thought I described it, but I'll just describe it again. It's not the Saturn Sun Lagrange points we're talking about for the sake of the moon. It's actually the Lagrange point between Saturn and the moon Dione. Those two bodies have their own L4, L5 Lagranges, and at those locations, they have these big rocks that are basically moons to Dione, called Helene and Polydeuces. And the same thing goes on at the Saturn and Tethys two-body Lagrange point. So yeah, there's no real nomenclature for, say, a sub-Lagrange point. You just have to define what your two bodies are, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's right. That sounds right. But when we're talking about the asteroids, that's a different topic, because then that would be the Sun-Jupiter Lagrange point. You know, talking about 4 and 5, that's, you know, those asteroids don't revolve around Jupiter. They, you know, they're just going along, they're following or leading, you know, between the Sun and Jupiter Lagrange point. So we got two different references, and everything's relative. Back to you, Rory.
C2GS. Well, that's my slogan for this entire science talk. Everything ultimately is semantics and everything is relative. So the asteroids that we were talking about, the Trojan asteroids and the Greek asteroids, are actually from the two-body of Jupiter and the Sun, and they rotate around the Sun, not Jupiter. And the beauty and the interesting thing to me about Lagrange points is that all the Lagrange points of, say, the Earth-Moon are traveling at the same period as the Earth around the Sun, which doesn't immediately make a lot of sense, because we're all sort of taught that if you can sustain yourself at a different distance from the Sun, you have to speed up if you come closer to the Sun, you have to slow down if you go farther from the Sun. So the only thing that should be able to have our periodicity is an orbit at exactly our orbit. Yet points are the method that we use to satellites that track us, even though they're not distinctly at the same distance from the Sun. So that's what I find particularly intriguing about the mathematics and the orbital mechanics of Lagrange points.
H with a comment.
Dick, I just wanted to make a mention about that tidal bulge that you mentioned before, about the tidal bulge on the opposite side of Earth from the moon. The best explanation I ever saw for that was in a science fiction story by Larry Niven called Neutron Star. Just to sum it up, if you could imagine a rock on the near side of the moon and a rock on the far side of the moon, as the moon orbits the Earth. Now, if the moon wasn't there, those two rocks would move apart from each other because they're in different orbital distances. But the moon is holding them together. So that's what makes that tidal bulge that you see on the Earth's tides. Go ahead.
And that's one way of explaining it, John. The wobble of the Earth around the barycenter is the other way. The water on the far side of the Earth, away from the moon, obvious by inverse square law, is experiencing less lunar gravity. Simultaneously, the Earth is wobbling around that point 1,000 miles below the equator on the side toward the moon. So the Earth is wobbling. If you accurately plotted the Earth's orbit around the sun, assuming it was a purely circular orbit, it's really slightly elliptical, but assuming it was a perfectly circular orbit, let me drop. You would find that you've got this nice, smooth circle that is the Earth's orbit, but when you look at the fine details, the line is not smooth. It wiggles back and forth roughly 12 times per year, caused by the moon's orbit around the Earth, that binary system. So we're wiggling, and that wiggle is throwing water out to the far side. I mean, a little bit similar to if I've got a pail of water, and I'm holding on to the handle of the pail, and I rotate my body around my mass center, the pail is now going around me, and if I move fast enough, the pail swings out at a 50-degree angle with my arm, and the water stays in the pail. So the moon is causing that kind of water slosh on the Earth is one way of explaining it. Over to you, John. K2LIW, wait for the beeps.
But with the explanation with these two rocks, it is that they would like to move apart from each other. That's what causes a moon to shatter if it gets too close to its primary, because these tidal forces are trying to pull it apart. And in the same way, the water on the far side of the Earth and the water on the other side closest to the moon is trying to stretch apart. And that force that's causing the bulge on the far side, just as a rock on the near side and far side of the moon, if the moon wasn't there, those two rocks in orbit would drift apart because they're at a different orbital distance. So there's this force that's trying to pull it apart. Go ahead.
I'm putting myself in the shoes of a person that's listening to you and I talking. And you're right, the two rocks are going to drift apart, but not along a straight line. The way you and I have worded it up till now is that I draw a straight line from the Earth center through the lunar center, and I've got one rock on that line on the near side of the moon. I got one rock on that rock on the far side of the moon along that line. That's my beginning condition. And by some means, I make the moon evaporate. The rock on the far side is in a bigger orbit. It's going to move around the Earth slower. So without a doubt, the rocks separate. The near rock moves forward, the far rock moves aft as far as the orbit is concerned. The majority of the separation is two different orbits at two different orbital velocities. So the shearing of the surface is a little bit more complicated, and pulling apart along that straight line. Does that sound reasonable, John? To A2VDH, K2RIW, and the TechNet?
I agree with you. I can see it's not going to be a direct radial shear. It's going to be sort of an off-center shear. But this is the same force that when an object gets too close to its primary, be it a moon or a planet too close to its sun, causes it to shatter. Isn't that what they thought happened that caused the rings of Saturn, that the moon got too close to it, and the tidal forces actually tore it apart? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm going to pass this one over to Roy in a second. What caused the rings of Saturn? There are people who believe that some moons collided, or an asteroid or a comet collided with a moon of Saturn and broke it up into a whole lot of fine particles. And whether or not the ring of Saturn is going to eventually coalesce, it appears that it's not going to, or it's going to take an awful long period of time. And that ring is moving in a very interesting manner. It's got a tremendous amount of width in change in radius between the inner edge and the outer edge. But its thickness of that ring is an extremely small number. Like, I think it's only a couple of miles. So it's a very thin disk. Obviously, when you wait to the portion of the orbit of Saturn around the Sun, there was times when the ring of Saturn lines up with the observation from the Earth. Let me drop. And unless you're using a very high-gain telescope, the ring is so thin that when it lines up with us correctly, it appears to essentially disappear. So I think there are lots of explanations of how the rings of Saturn came about. And by the way, Saturn is not the only thing with rings. I think Jupiter has a very minor ring. Uranus and Neptune, I think, also have a very minor ring. AC2GS, K2RIW. Bring us up to speed on this one, Roy. K2RIW.
I wish I could give you the definitive answer, but there is none. All of these theories have been proposed. All of them still exist as possibilities. None have been disproven to my knowledge. We just unfortunately don't know enough. There are studies ongoing, and yes, it's a fascinating thing to look at the patterns and how they change. I mean, what might be of interest to the people out there is anyone out there kind of have an idea of why everything seems flat? If you look at Saturn's rings, they're flat. If you look at orbital mechanics of our solar system, it tends to be flat. If you look at many, not all, but many galaxies, they tend to be disks that are rather flat. So anyone out there has an idea of why the heck everything is so flat?
AC2LR with a guess.
Okay, guess away.
It's the same principle as when a pizza man takes a blob of dough and he flings it up in the air and spins it, and then it flattens out into a disc of pizza dough. I don't know what the physics term is for that, but I call it the pizza dough theory.
Okay, that would sort of explain why it stretches out and flattens, but there are actually galaxies that don't do that. One of the things is there are some quantities that are conserved and some quantities that aren't conserved. And one of those things that are conserved is called angular momentum. All the gases generally have some kind of angular momentum. They kind of merge together, and they keep it no matter what you do with them. You stretch them out, you shrink them, they'll still have the same angular momentum. But since between the top and the bottom of any kind of spinning galaxy has a gravitational energy as it bounces back and forth that isn't conserved. And what happens is it dissipates it through electromagnetic energy to have the lowest possible gravitational potential energy. So that flattens it, but you'll never have your spin slow down because that's angular momentum and that's conserved. So that's why most things tend to be flat. because they're seeking a gravitational low potential point, and they're able to get rid of that excess energy by simply emitting electromagnetic waves. Go ahead.
I just came in on the conversation when you were talking about the Trojan asteroids around Jupiter. Wasn't one of the reasons they demoted Pluto, was it because, one of the reasons was it couldn't clear its own orbit. So how are the Trojan asteroids in Jupiter's orbit different from debris in Pluto's orbit? AC2LR.
Okay, that's a good question, and I wish I was an astronomer and had a really good answer. I'm assuming that it's a special case condition for L4 and L5 asteroids. Since it's a stable orbit, those things are going to stay for the next 100 million years. So I think that they give planets a pass if they have asteroids in their L4 and L5, as opposed to any other place in their path.
Okay, thank you.
Roy, do we know of specific things in the orbit of Pluto that Pluto has not cleared away? I mean, they said it didn't clear its orbit. What did it not clear? Yes, there are, moons out there, but did they specifically name the things that Pluto did not clear? Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
I don't believe they've named any of the bodies. They just seem to have located these random objects in its path. That's not the only reason either. It's a size issue. There's a whole bunch of reasons why people have it in for Pluto, for Pluto.
Along these lines, when you view our solar system by what we in the Northern Hemisphere call the top view, everything seems to be counterclockwise. All planets go around the sun counterclockwise. Almost all planets rotate on their axis counterclockwise. Essentially all moons go around their planet counterclockwise. But I think there is a moon of Saturn or Jupiter, I'm not sure which, Saturn or Jupiter, there is a moon around one of those planets that goes around clockwise. And if it ever smacks into another one of the moons, that's going to be another ring-creating episode. So to have a moon go around a planet in our solar system clockwise is a rather rare event, and try to explain how it came about is not easy. It sounds like a capture phenomenon. AC2GS, K2LAW, and the TechNet.
WS2N. Yeah, that would be Triton around Neptune. That's the one that goes in reverse retrograde orbit. And, yeah, I've heard that the capture is a possibility. They're still looking into that. We have close pictures of it. When Voyager went by, that was the last pictures that it took of a planetary body, you know, the moon of Triton. But, that one goes backwards. Back to you, back to Dick.
Back to Roy.
Gosh, we're playing hot potato. Let me pick up a couple of little points that I didn't make last week when I was discussing how people measure things astronomically. One of the things I really didn't grab onto was how masses are calculated. And the way that masses tend to be calculated initially is, again, using binary star systems, because when you're seeing a binary star in action, you can go with Kepler's third equation of orbital mechanics and put